Shalom, welcome to SJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chazdai, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers this week, I have to speak about a subject that I have spoken to you about many times before, because the threat is so great. The threat of an Iranian nuclear holocaust, the threat of a nuclear arms race among Muslim terrorist states in the Middle East, because if Iran acquires nuclear bombs, God forbid, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, Syria, Jordan are all going to want to acquire nuclear bombs in response. So the enormity of this danger is so great that we have to speak about it and address this issue once again and understand what the full implications are of what's going on over here. Now the media reports, even the media reports, that Barack Hussein Obama and John Kerry were never even enforcing the sanctions that Congress had passed into law. Congress passed sanctions into law. Obama signed them during the presidential campaign because, if you recall, he always tried to dilute the sanctions, always tried to oppose the sanctions, was always against sanctions on Iran. But during the presidential campaign, because Mitt Romney was attacking him, he signed the congressional sanctions into law, but he never enforced them. He ordered his administration illegally not to enforce the law because he wanted to protect his fellow Muslims in terrorist Iran. And even the New York Nazi Times now reports this in a front page, a big front page story that they did earlier this week. And the news media is full of reports about how the sanctions were never really enforced against Iran by the Obama administration, which is blatantly illegal and which very, very seriously endangers the national security and even the survival of the United States, Israel, and the rest of the world. Who told you this? Before the New York Nazi Times reported this on their front page, before the news media acknowledged that this is happening, before we all found out that the Obama administration isn't even enforcing the pathetic sanctions that Congress had passed, who told you this from the start? Who told you again and again that Obama dilutes the sanctions, that he doesn't enforce the sanctions, that he can't be trusted even when sanctions are put in place to do what the sanctions require of him? Who told you this all along? Who did video after video and program after program, even here on AskJTF, who told you this repeatedly, consistently? We were the only ones that said this all along. AIPAC and the so-called Israel lobby that's really an anti-Israel lobby, the Jewish establishment organizations, all the organizations, all the groups that deal with this issue. None of them said that this is happening, because none of them could imagine that Obama would do something this blatant against American law and that nobody would do anything and nobody would hold him accountable for it. But we knew that he could do anything he wants and gets away with it because he's black. Because if you say anything against him, it's racist. So he could do anything he wants and gets away with it. We were the only ones who told you this was happening. We told you from the start that even the sanctions that were being passed, that Netanyahu and Israel and all the idiots that are running the Israeli government, all the fools and the traitors that are running Israel were depending on, that even these sanctions were worthless. They were a paper tiger. They weren't being enforced. And now we see it on the front page of the New York Nazi Times saying this, and there's no newspaper that worships Obama more than the New York Nazi Times. And now they're trying to work out in Geneva a so-called deal with Iran. Barack Hussein Obama and John Kerry, whose paternal grandfather was a Jew named Cohen, and so he has that self-hating, ugly, Judenrat, capo, vile desire to destroy whatever part of him, whatever blood, whatever Jewish blood he had in him, he wants to destroy that vile, vicious, self-hating anti-Semite. John Kerry and Barack Hussein Obama are trying to work out an agreement with Iran that will let Iran build the nuclear bombs without sanctions, and they'll pretend that they're not really doing it. They'll pretend that they have an agreement. They'll have an agreement for the sake of an agreement. That is what's going on. even France, and France is not known as being some tough nation that takes tough stands in negotiations, even the French said this is a farce, and the French refused to support the Obama-Kerry proposal to Iran. The French publicly pulled out and condemned it. Because Obama brought together all the nations in Europe and all the countries and brought them together to negotiate with Iran. And the French said, what is this? What, are you kidding? This isn't any type of agreement. The Iranians are getting everything here on a silver platter, and they're continuing to build nuclear bombs. They're continuing to enrich uranium. They're continuing to march toward nuclear bombs. And what the agreement would do, at best, would be allow Iran to have nuclear capability, meaning that Iran can quickly construct the nuclear bomb anytime they want to within weeks. They'd have the nuclear capability, and within weeks they could assemble a nuclear bomb whenever they want. That would be at best, and at worst, of course, Iran would actually build nuclear bombs. And in exchange, all the sanctions are lifted, and Iran's economy is allowed to progress, and everything goes on as usual. And of course, the other Muslim countries in the Middle East will respond to this by wanting to get nuclear bombs of their own. This is unbelievable that nobody listened to us when we warned for years and years that this was going to happen. For years and years, we said Israel must take military action to destroy this nuclear bomb-making program. And for years and years, we warned that if Obama's elected and re-elected, that this is what he was going to do. And everybody and all the Jewish establishment leaders and even the Jewish Republicans all said, that's nonsense. What are you talking about? Now they're saying, well, Obama says, well, we're not going to allow Iran to get nuclear bombs. Just like he said, you can keep your health plan. If you like your health plan, you can keep it. If you like your doctor, you can keep it. Now he's saying, we're not going to allow Iran. He was saying, we're not going to allow Iran to get nuclear bombs. And people still listen to what this lying Muslim piece of human excrement says. Netanyahu, he's complaining. He's publicly complaining because he knows that his country's very survival is in grave danger now. So what's he doing? Instead of sending out the Israeli Air Force to say, screw you, Obama, we're going to take care of this. Instead of doing that, he's complaining. He's criticizing it as a bad deal. And all the Israeli leaders are saying it's a bad deal. By the way, Israelis from the left to the right, even Yechimovich from the Labor Party is condemning it, and even from Meretz and from the far left to the phony right. When I say from the left to the right, there is no right. We're the only right wing Jews. There is no right wing in Israeli politics. From the phony right to the far left, all of them are agreeing with Netanyahu on this issue. They all agree. Everyone in Israel is saying that this is a sellout. Everyone in Israel is agreeing with Netanyahu that Obama and Kerry are selling Israel out now. This agreement right across the board, even the Israeli news media, is against what Obama and Kerry are doing. That's how bad it is. But no one is saying. So why the hell aren't you moving militarily? No one is even asking the question. The reason he's not moving militarily is because he doesn't want Obama to get mad at him and the Europeans, and the New York Nazi Times will have an editorial attacking Israel. That worries this criminal traitor, this disgusting, horrible individual, Bibi Netanyahu. This worries him more than a nuclear Iran and a nuclearized Middle East surrounding little Israel. If only we had the resources that we begged people to give us over the years. If only we had those resources, what a difference we could have made. Because if only we had had those resources, if only we could do what had to be done. If only we could reach the people of Israel, there would have been a lot of pressure on Netanyahu from the Israeli public. A lot of pressure on him. The Israeli public is very concerned about this. They sense that this is a very dangerous situation. And if we had been able to say, with a drumbeat of criticism and condemnation, oh, this is so terrible, you keep saying it's so terrible, and you keep saying Israel, though, could militarily, if she wants to, could militarily deal with this, so why don't you militarily deal with it? And there would finally be the type of debate in Israel that there has to be, and we would put pressure on Netanyahu, and we could have saved Israel from this situation. Because we didn't have the budget necessary to reach the people of Israel. This is why we're in this situation. All the terrible situations we've been in for the past 20 years have been because the Kahanists don't, the real Kahanists, which is us, don't have the real resources. All of Israel's bad situations are because of that. On life and death issues, only we have told the truth. And that's a fact. What a disgrace. The one movement that tells the truth and that has been right on the start on all of these issues, the one movement doesn't have a real budget, has a budget of tens of thousands of dollars. What a disgrace. And the leader of the movement, Chaim Ben Pesach, is banned from even setting foot in Israel. You think they're banning me because they're worried I'm going to do something illegal? They're banning me because they don't like the fact that I'm telling the truth to the people of Israel that could save the people of Israel, and they don't want someone who tells the truth. But most Jews in Israel, most Jews in America, will never get to hear that truth because of our limited budget. They never get to hear these words. They never get to hear these facts. And that is a crime, an unforgivable crime. And so what do we do now? What do we do in this situation? They're meeting again in shortly, and they're trying to iron out this agreement with Iran, which will basically allow Iran to do whatever they want. And Israel is not acting. They're just publicly complaining and bluffing as they always do. What do we do now? Most people aren't going to hear our message. The answer is we still are not allowed to be silent. We must never be silent. We must never give up. We have to always keep fighting as best we can with whatever we have. As honest truth tellers, as honest principled people, we have to keep standing up for the truth because no one else will. And eventually the truth will be known. It may be known after a terrible catastrophe, God forbid. It may be known after a nuclear holocaust takes place, God forbid. It may be known after all types of terrible things happen, God forbid. But eventually the truth will be known. Eventually someone will know that there was one group that did tell the truth, and that is important. I'm hoping that we can still avoid this, and I'm hoping God will have mercy on the Jewish people and mercy on Israel, mercy on America, and will save Israel and America from this catastrophe somehow. God sometimes mercifully saves us, even though we don't deserve it. And we don't deserve it. We don't deserve it. But sometimes God in His mercy, and we pray to God that He should be merciful, sometimes He does save us anyway. Someday the truth will be known. Someday there'll be real leaders in Israel for the Jewish people. That'll happen someday. I don't know when. But someday it's going to happen. We know because God and the prophets and the Bible tell us that the Jews are going to return to God, that the Jews are going to believe in God, that it's going to usher in the redemption. The redemption already started with the resurrection of the State of Israel in 1948, 65 years ago. But the final redemption with the coming of the Messiah and Techiyat HaMetim and all the other great things that are going to happen, all of those wonderful things are going to happen. That's going to happen. And the Jews are going to return. The Jews are going to regret the wrong that they did. And are going to regret their foolish behavior. They're going to regret all of that. And many of the Jews will return to God. And will do the right thing eventually. We know that. And they're going to pick the right leaders. And eventually we're going to have the right leaders that are going to make a difference. And they're going to do what has to be done. We know that's going to happen. When it will happen, I don't know. I don't know. I can't tell you because I'm not a prophet, but it will happen. In the meantime, we are not allowed to be silent. And let me just give you an illustration, though, of who we do reach. We do reach thousands of people all the time. Every day we reach thousands of people. Just on Facebook alone. Here's an illustration of how many people we reach, for instance, every day on Facebook. If someone likes our pages, they receive our videos on Facebook. They also receive our messages. When we send out messages or begin new subjects on Facebook, they receive the new subjects, they receive the videos, they receive our messages on a daily basis. We now have over 1,300 likes on our Hayamin Hamiti page on Facebook. Over 1,300 likes. Hayamin Hamiti is our Hebrew movement. Over 1,300 likes. We have over 850 likes on our JTF English language Facebook page. We have over 260 likes on our Ted Cruz presidential campaign page. We have over 700 likes on our old Romney for President page. Why do we have an old Romney for President Facebook page still? Not because the Romney campaign, of course, is over, but the reason we do is because stupid Facebook doesn't allow us to change the name of the page. They won't allow us to change the name after we have a certain number of likes. So we have to keep that name, the Romney name, even though the campaign is over. We have to keep it. We don't want to close down the page because we have over 700 people on it. We don't want to close that down. We're still reaching people with our videos and with our messages. So we have over 700 people on that page. And we have over 1,040 likes on my personal Chaim Ben Pesach page. So we have well over 3,000 likes on our official Facebook pages. Over 3,000 likes. Okay, and that doesn't count other JTF members and Hayamin members that have their own pages and that also publicize us. I mean, that's not even counting that. I'm just talking about the ones directly connected to our movement in Israel, our movement here, the ones directly immediately connected. We have over 3,000 likes, so over 3,000 people receive our messages, either our videos or the messages or the things that we post every single day on those pages. Over 3,000 people are getting that. More than two-thirds of those people are Israeli Jews. Okay? If you add up the numbers, the Hebrew-speaking Israeli Jews are more than two-thirds. They're more than two-thirds of the over 3,000 people that get our messages on Facebook. I mean, because if you look at we have over 1,300 likes on the Hayamin page, and the 10,040 likes on my personal Chaim Ben Pesach page, more than 80% of the people on my personal Chaim Ben Pesach page are Israeli Jews. So we're reaching thousands of people just on Facebook. Automatically, we reach thousands of people just on Facebook. In addition to that, of course, we reach many more people on YouTube, and we reach people on our forums and on our websites. We have visitors, you can see in our stats that we have people who come and visit us every day who are not members, who come and see what we write and what we say and are interested in what we write and what we say. So we're reaching thousands of people. But we see from this latest situation that reaching thousands of people when you have a crisis like this is not nearly enough. It's what I've been saying every week to you. It's just not enough. We've got to reach much more. We're trying our best, and we got to continue to speak out. We got to continue to do our best. We got to continue to reach as many people as we can. We're not allowed to be silent. And reaching thousands of people is much better than reaching no one, than doing nothing, God forbid. So we are accomplishing something. I mean, we're touching the lives of thousands of people, more than two-thirds of whom are young Israeli Jews. So you never know what those young Israeli Jews will eventually become leaders, and eventually who knows the influence and the impact that can have. Who knows what that can lead to? Thousands of young Israeli Jews every day are exposed to our messages. Thousands. I urge you, by the way, to make sure to like all of our Facebook pages. Because the more likes we have on our Facebook pages, the stronger our position will be in the Facebook and Google search engines. And by the way, unlike other groups who have a budget and who buy likes, other groups, by the way, buy likes. We don't buy likes. We don't do anything like that. All of our likes, every single like we have is legitimate. We never spent one penny advertising on Facebook, never spent one penny buying likes. We don't have any reason to buy likes. We want real likes. We want real, genuine people that we reach and that we influence. But our likes are all genuine, unlike most of these other groups. Ours are genuine. Every single like we have is genuine, is for real. And our views on our YouTube videos are all for real. We don't buy views. I don't know if you can buy views. I think in the past you could. I don't know if you still can. I don't know. I don't know what YouTube is constantly making changes. I don't know what you can do now, what you can't do. Who knows? Who knows what the situation is? But we do not buy views on our YouTube videos. And so it's important that people like our Facebook pages, be active in our Facebook pages. Also be active on our forums, of course. Make them inviting places so that people want to be more active with us. A lot of people who aren't even part of the likes and who aren't JTF or Hayamin members of our forums come and look out of curiosity and check us out of curiosity. So it's important that we influence those people. You never know what that will lead to. You never know what their curiosity and their reading our stuff and seeing our videos, you never know what that will lead to. We also urge you, when we do Hebrew and English videos, to like, favorite, comment, share, and mirror all of our Hebrew and English videos on YouTube and on Facebook. Promote them all over the place. Like, favorite, comment, share, and mirror. Very important. And finally, of course, our biggest downfall is our budget. Whatever people can afford to help with, people should help. Whatever you can afford to do, whatever you can afford to help with, you should help. We need help. The more help we get, the better we can do, the better a job we can do of reaching whomever we can reach. Checks, money orders, cash donations made out to our post office box, sent to our post office box in the regular mail. Very, very important. And I want to thank the JTFers the past couple of weeks. More people have been sending. I don't know why, but the past couple of weeks were actually better for us than were actually pretty good for us the past couple of weeks by our standard. I mean, compared to other organizations, it's a joke. But for us, our donations actually are up the past couple of weeks. I don't know what the explanation for that is, but I thank the great JTFers. God bless the JTFers who've been helping us. And of course, if other people want to use their credit card, they can go to the donate button on our English and Hebrew main pages. This is a very important time, and we got to stand up and tell the truth, and we've got to do what has to be done, because no one else is willing to do it. We're fighting on every front. We're trying to wake up Israeli Jews and influence what's happening in Israel, and doing our best. Doing the best we can to do that. Our movement in Israel, especially if you count the Facebook pages, our movement in Israel is actually probably about double the size of the movement in America now because of the Facebook pages. But our movement is trying to influence things in Israel, doing the best we can to spread the word and influence as best we can. Here in the United States, you see what we're doing. We're doing English language videos, and we're trying to influence even the presidential election campaign that already, believe it or not, has already started, and that does influence what happens in terms of policy in the next 3 years. What you do in election politics influences policy as well. We're doing the best we can and working as hard as we can, and everybody is obligated to do the best they can in this situation. We're all obligated to stand up for the truth and stand up for justice. We have to fight for righteousness and for justice and for truth and for principles. That's what we're required to do. That's why we were put into this world. To be apathetic, to be indifferent when you see injustice, when you see danger, when you see terrible things coming, is the worst thing possible, to be apathetic and indifferent. And the vast majority of people are, and it's a terrible thing. But we in JTF and in Hayamin Hamiti, our Hebrew movement, will not be like that. We're going to keep fighting for truth until the day comes when we create a mass movement of idealists that demand justice and righteousness, that demand idealism and demand policies that reflect the values that God commands us to believe in. Anyway, I know I've spoken about this issue before, and I know I brought this up before, but I don't think anyone can deny the importance of it and how much of a danger it is becoming, and how close we are now to this danger, how close the Iranian Muslim Nazis are to building nuclear bombs and how close we are to this worldwide acceptance and appeasement of Iran, while everything we warned about, everything we said was going to happen, is coming true, very sadly. We would love to come to you instead of saying, oh, we told you so, everything we said was going to happen is happening. Instead of that, we'd like to come to you and say, you see, we saved the situation because of the help from all of these great people. We were able to save the situation. That's the message we prefer to give you. And God willing, the day will come when we're going to give you that message. But in the meantime, we've got to keep fighting. We're not allowed to stop fighting. We've got to keep fighting. And I think that all of my fellow JTFers understand the importance, the critical importance of this battle. Okay, let's get to our questions now. And we start out with the great Wandering Samurai 81, who writes, and I quote, Der Chaim, why does Russia support Syria, unquote? The reason is because Russia wants a foothold in the Middle East. Russia would like to take over the Middle East. And Vladimir Putin, the KGB agent, and he was all of his life with the KGB, which is the Soviet Gestapo, Vladimir Putin wants to recreate the Soviet Empire. And so he wants to reestablish and continue relations with all of the Muslim Nazi countries that the Soviet Empire supported, Syria, Egypt, and so on. And Iran, he supports Iran. Putin and Russia support Iran as well. They're the ones who've been building the nuclear program for Iran. It's amazing. They're part of the negotiations that Obama and Kerry invited. They invited them to the negotiations with Iran, the Russians, while the Russians are building the nuclear bombs for Iran, are building the nuclear facilities to enable the Iranians to create nuclear bombs. I mean, what a farce. What a farce this, and the Russians are part of the negotiations to supposedly control the nuclear program. They're the ones responsible for the nuclear program. They have built most of the technology. They built the reactor, and they built most of the technology for the nuclear program. I mean, it's just, this is so Orwellian, it is so farcical. And again, the problem is, who is out there telling the truth to everyone, not to thousands of people, like we are? We need to be telling this truth to millions of Israeli Jews and tens of millions of Americans. That's what we need to do. But as long as we don't have the budget to do that, we're going to continue to at least to tell it to thousands of people. Thank you, Wandering Samurai 81. And now we go to the great Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, since the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination is coming up, do you think there was a conspiracy in killing Kennedy, unquote? I don't know. I don't know if there was, you know, the Warren Commission claimed that there was not, claimed that there was just Lee Harvey Oswald. But there are all types of, I have seen some of the claims from people who say there is a conspiracy. One thing I can tell you for sure, the claim that Lyndon Johnson, and I hate Lyndon Johnson, he was an evil animal. But the claim that Lyndon Johnson had Kennedy killed is ridiculous. That's absurd. Okay. The vice president is not going to have the order that the president be assassinated. I mean, that's just ridiculous. That there is no way that that would happen because they would never get away with it. That's just absurd. I mean, it's just absurd. Not that Johnson was a good guy. He was an evil person. He was a terrible president, evil person. An enemy, by the way, of Israel and the Jewish people as well. Not only was he a bad president for the United States, but he certainly didn't order Kennedy's assassination or this other nonsense. There's some of the things that are said are so absurd. But the possibility that there were other people involved in the assassination, other people, I'm not talking about the vice president or the CIA or these other ridiculous conspiracy, crazy conspiracy quacks, the things that they come up with. But the possibility that there were other, perhaps the Soviets or perhaps other people involved, that, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer to that. Anyway, thank you, Joe. And now we go to our great friend Lewinsky Stinks, Dr. Brennan Rocks, who writes, and I quote, discuss how Bible-believing Christians get brainwashed into becoming Ron Paul, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, zombies, unquote. Well, you know, Bible-believing Christians, like Bible-believing Jews, have free will. They have free will. Just because somebody says they're an evangelical Christian doesn't mean that they have to follow everything that certain evangelical Christians say you have to follow. Just as Orthodox Jews, you have different Orthodox Jews doing all types of things. People have free will. And there are people who call themselves Bible-believing Christians, who believe in all types of things, who support Ron Paul. There are people who call themselves Bible-believing Christians who support David Duke. There are people who call themselves Bible-believing Christians who are Nazis. There are people who call themselves Bible-believing Christians who support the Muslims. You know, and I'm not talking about, by the way, the Episcopalians and these other left-wing churches. I'm talking about people who claim to have had a born-again experience, who claim to be part of this, of what they call the born-again experience, and claim to be spirit-filled Christians, and then they join the Identity Church, which is a Nazi church. So, you know, just because somebody says they're an evangelical Christian doesn't mean that they can't go off and do, out of their own free will, do something that's out of this world, that's crazy. Ron Paul and Rand Paul represent everything that is the antithesis of what the Bible stands for. I mean, we just did it. We did a great video, I have to say, on Rand Paul's plagiarism, really showing him up for, and that's an example of a great video that everybody should see, that really should be publicized. If we were a mass movement, everyone would see that video, and Rand Paul would be in a lot of trouble as a result of that video. But anyway, this is, you know, you have people who are Bible-believing Christians who do crazy things. You have people who you have Bible-believing Jews who also do crazy things. So it's all a matter of free will, and that's unfortunately people can choose to do things that are insane. Lewinsky Stinks also writes, and I quote, "Also discuss how it's hard to find a religious spouse." Unquote. Well, finding a spouse is obviously very difficult. You're speaking to the right person when it comes to that. You don't want to be too picky. You don't want to look for perfection. If you look for perfection, you might wind up being a 57-year-old bachelor. So you don't want to be too picky. And, you know, there are other reasons why, unfortunately, I'm not married yet. I do want to get married. I still intend to get married, God willing. But there are other reasons why. There are other all types of reasons involving my aliyah to Israel and involving the fact that I was in prison and everything else, and, you know, that definitely interfered with my desire to get married. But in general, speaking in general now, putting that aside right now, speaking in general, finding a lifetime spouse is not easy. It's not easy. It's very hard. You know, you got to find somebody that you think will complement your characteristics, your traits, your character traits, and that will be a lifetime partner. And that's not easy to do, but it is doable. We know it's doable because we see millions of happy couples that do achieve it. If they achieve it, that means other people can achieve it. So it's doable. It's not easy, but it's doable. Thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. And now we go to the great Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "Please discuss Luis Quintana, the new mayor of Newark, New Jersey," unquote. I don't know anything about him other than he was in the city council in Newark and they appointed him. He's not going to be mayor for long. He's not running for a full term, I think, if I'm correct. But he was in the city council in Newark, and that means he's a disaster. Anyone associated with Newark and the city council and the city government there is a disaster. It's a city filled with crime and drugs and murder and blood. It's a horrible, evil, parasitic city that lives on welfare and food stamps and housing projects and all the ugly aspects of urban America. The ugliest aspects of urban America, you have all of that in Newark, New Jersey. And he was a part of that, so obviously he's a terrible person. And now Binyamin writes, too, did Fat Fatty make the Senate election earlier than the regular election so Fag Faggy would win his own re-election without Booker on the same ballot, which would have drawn the Democrats in larger numbers, unquote. Okay, what Binyamin, the answer to your question, a short answer to your question, Binyamin, is yes. And what Binyamin is referring to is there was a special election for the U.S. Senate because fortunately Frank Lautenberg, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, a self-hating Jewish anti-Semite, finally passed away, thank God. And so they had to have a special election to fill the seat. And actually, they didn't have to have. They could have allowed the seat. You know, they could have actually allowed the election to go on until the end of Lautenberg's term. I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail, but basically, what Chris Christie did here in New Jersey was waste tens of millions of taxpayer dollars and hold a special election in October of this year, last month, for the U.S. Senate seat, when he could have scheduled the election on Election Day with the race for governor and all the other elections that you have in New Jersey. This November, you had an election for governor in New Jersey for the state legislature, for local offices. Chris Christie could have said, okay, the U.S. Senate election is going to be on regular Election Day in November, together with the race for governor and the state legislature. Instead, he ordered a special second election only a few weeks before the November election for the U.S. Senate that cost tens of millions of dollars. It wasted tens of millions of tax dollars in New Jersey. Why? Because he knew the Democrat was going to win, and he figured having a Democrat who was going to win running for the U.S. Senate, Cory Booker, would draw votes away from him and would draw votes toward his Democrat opponent. So just so that he would have a little bit of a higher margin in the race for governor and a little bit of a higher margin of victory, he wasted tens of millions of taxpayer dollars in New Jersey. Chris Christie is a corrupt, dishonest fraud, a big fat fraud. And he will do any destructive policy just so that he himself can get ahead. That's what he's all about. Anyway, thank you, Binyamin. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, one, elaborate on Dina and a 13th tribe, unquote. Okay, great question. As we know, Yaakov, Jacob, had 12 sons. And those 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. But Yaakov also had one daughter, Dinah, who ideally would have married someone, and that would have led to the 13th tribe. If she had married someone who could have created the 13th tribe, you could have had the 13th tribe. And she would have to marry someone, of course, who's not Jewish, because there was no Jewish people in those days. It was just her 12 brothers. So she would have married someone who's not Jewish. And the person that she would have married would have been someone from the lineage of Esav. She couldn't have married Esav as Esau. She couldn't have married Esav himself because he was already 98 years old and she was like 3 years old. There was like a 95-year difference between them. But she could have married his grandson or she could have married his great-grandson. And then her baby would have been Jewish, her children and the tribe, they would have been Jewish because the mother, if you have a Jewish mother, it's Jewish. The father would not have been Jewish, but, you know, you would have had a connection, a strong connection in that tribe between the Jews and the Gentiles. It would have been a bridge between the Jews and the Gentiles, and it would have led to a quicker redemption. To a better situation in terms of Geulah, in terms of redemption of the world. The problem was that, and we have to remember, Esav came from Yitzchak. Esav came from Isaac. Esav was Yaakov's brother. So he could have been righteous. If Esav had been righteous, he would have represented the Gentile nations. And he would have been righteous. And if his grandson had been righteous, if his lineage had been righteous, and had married Dinah, there would have been this bridge between the Jews and the Gentiles, a bridge for the Gentiles to Bible Judaism, to Torah Judaism, and the world would have been a different place. However, Esav was evil. It couldn't happen because Esav was evil, and Esav's grandson and great-grandson were evil. You know who Esav's grandson was? Or you know at least one of his grandsons were? Amalek. Who represents the Nazis, who represents those that want to exterminate the Jewish people, the most evil people on the face of the earth, are Amalek. And that is That was Esav's grandson, and that would have been the person who, if he had been righteous, would have been perfect for Dinah, to marry Dinah. By the way, if this sounds strange, that Dinah would have been marrying a Gentile when we don't believe in intermarriage, the 12 sons of Yaakov marry Gentile women. Right? Because there were no Jews at the time. This, at the time, you know, was the only thing you could do. So, there would have been a more universalist 13th tribe with a bridge toward the Gentiles. That's what could have happened, but it didn't happen because Esav was evil and his grandson Amalek was evil. And then Dinah eventually was brutally raped by Shechem. She was eventually raped by Shechem, which is another long story in the Torah. And so it never came to be that there would be this 13th tribe. Because of these circumstances, because of free will and people choosing to be evil. And now Dr. Dan writes, and I quote too, talk about the reunion of Esav and Yaakov, or Esau and Jacob. Okay. Esav and Yaakov get together after Yaakov was with Lavan. He left the land of Israel to flee his brother because his brother wanted to kill him. He left the land of Israel and was outside the land of Israel for 20 years. Comes back after 20 years to the land of Israel, and his brother is coming to meet him. Now Yaakov has his two wives, and he has children with the two wives, and he has other people that he brought with him that became part of his household. So he has a pretty extensive household with a lot of cattle and a lot of other things that he's bringing with him. And Esav is coming at him with 400 soldiers. So we're taught that when that happens, he prepares with three things. This is Rashi. Rashi, who is one of the great rabbinic sages. Rashi tells us that there are three things that Yaakov prepares with before meeting Esav. Esav represents evil. He represents an evil anti-Semite who threatens the Jewish people. And Yaakov, of course, represents the ultimate righteousness. So we're taught that he prepared with three things. He prepared with ledoron, litfila, ulemilchama. Ledoron means with a gift. Litfila means a prayer. And ulemilchama means, and for war. So in other words, he prepared for a gift, to give a gift. He wanted to give a gift, what we call a mincha, a gift to, in other words, first he wanted to say, we want peace. We're not looking for war. We're not looking for a fight with you. So he first went to Esav with a gift and sent him a gift. After that prayer, they prayed. And after that, they prepared for war. The third thing that they prepared for was just in case Esav decided to attack them, they would be ready for war. And that's the three things that you're supposed to do. You're supposed to first, when you're dealing with nations of the world, first you're supposed to be ready. The Jewish people want peace. And the Jewish people, want peace. And the Jewish, by the way, if you ask, well, should we be offering peace deals to the Arabs? No, because the Arabs already for over 100 years have attacked us. It's too late for that. Once the Arabs started to attack and said they want to destroy us, it's too late. Then it's over. Then it's wartime. But anyway, at first, before you know what the intentions of a nation is, you first want peace, you desire peace. You also pray. You say you have to pray. That's the second thing you do. And the third thing you do is prepare for war, just in case they decide to go against you. That's what Yaakov did, and that is what a Jewish leader is supposed to do when you're first dealing with a new nation or a new challenge. And that's, again, something Rashi taught us that Yaakov did. And they finally get together. Esav decides not to attack Yaakov, and instead he invites Yaakov and his family to join with him. He said, join us, we're brothers, let's be together. Yaakov declines the offer, though, because it's an offer really to assimilate. It's an offer to mix in with Esav and assimilate and adopt the evil culture of Esav. He knows Esav is an evil murderer and an idol worshiper, and he doesn't want his family to assimilate and become part of that culture. So he says, no, you'll go your way, I'll go. He very nicely convinces Esav that each should go their own way, and they do, in fact, peaceably each go their own way. But he refuses to assimilate and go together with Esav and accept his offer to assimilate and get together with him, which is another thing that a Jewish leader should be strong about. Okay, and now Dr. Dan writes, and I quote, three, if Obama were president in the 80s, how would the JDL act, unquote. Well, I mean, it depends what issue we're talking about. If there had been a left-wing president instead of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan was president in the 80s when we led our campaign to free Soviet Jews. If there had been a left-wing president instead, it would have been much more difficult for us. Our campaign to free Soviet Jews would have been much more difficult. The fact that we had someone like Ronald Reagan in the White House was something that helped. Even though Ronald Reagan did not stand up for Soviet Jewry, did not fight for Soviet Jewry when he met with Gorbachev until we forced him to. Even Ronald Reagan did not say to Gorbachev, hey, you got to let the Soviet Jews out, otherwise I'm not dealing with you. He didn't do that. He didn't do that. He signed an arms control agreement with him. He had trade with the Soviets. He was meeting with the Soviets. And he did not ever condition any of those agreements on freeing Soviet Jews, which was our demand. But nevertheless, the fact that Reagan stood strong against the Soviets helped us when we also stood strong and demanded that they free the Soviet Jews. It put us in a better position. And it made a difference. It made a difference. If there had been a left-wing president like Obama, it would have been, God forbid, it would have been much more difficult. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great Chicago Jew who writes, and I quote, what is your opinion on the movie Cast a Giant Shadow, unquote. I spoke about this. Somebody asked me about this several weeks ago. I think it was a good movie. There are aspects of the movie that I'm not thrilled with. Because they support Jewish assimilationists who make them into heroes. But overall, the movie was very pro-Israel, very pro-Israel. Hollywood at that time was pro-Israel. Even the self-hating intermarried Jews in that movie, who starred in that movie, were all pro-Israel. All of them were pro-Israel. In the 1960s. America was very pro-Israel, and Hollywood was pro-Israel. If you went against Israel in those days, you were considered to be an anti-Semite. The media was pro-Israel. The media was actually pro-Israel in the 1960s, not the New York Nazi Times or Time Magazine. I mean, there were exceptions. There's some that are just so vicious Nazi. They're such vicious Nazi publications. Time Magazine was always a Nazi Jew-hating publication, no matter what. The New York Nazi Times always was against Israel, no matter what. But most of the media even was pro-Israel in the 1960s. That's the way the world existed in those days. And so it shows what a different world we had at that time. And there were reasons for that. It was only 25 years after the Holocaust, and memories of the Holocaust were fresh in people's minds. Israel was courageously winning battles at that time instead of getting on their hands and knees like they do now. I mean, it was a different world. It was a different world at that time. And now, unfortunately, the situation is completely different. And that movie is an example. You know, the movies out of Hollywood, whether it was Exodus or Cast the Giant Shadow, were all pro-Israel. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And now we go to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, I asked about Haredim, but I want a clearer answer, please. Cuts to the yeshivot, a good thing? Should we work to destroy their ideology, unquote? Well, I think it depends. I mean, if you're talking about institutions like Shas, Shas is a corrupt, evil movement that brainwashes their students into saying the Jews should give up land, that the land of Israel is something that we don't have to keep. You know, there are some, we would like to move them away from that ideology. But you can't just shut down their yeshivot and instead, you can't do that. I mean, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work if we suddenly decide we're cutting off everything. We're just cutting off everything to the yeshivot. We do want to gradually move them away from that ideology. And we do eventually want to strip the corrupt people, like Shas, from running big yeshiva systems in Israel. We do eventually want to try to move them away as effectively as we can. We want to try to move them away from those yeshivas into yeshivot that believe in the land of Israel, that preach love of the Jewish people, that are not corrupt. Obviously, we would like to do that. Yes, we would like to do that, but we can't. You can't do that overnight. You can't. It has to be a very gradual process, because the yeshiva world is a very sensitive world, and if you do that, you can get a big backlash from them that will just backfire in your face. So it has to be done intelligently, cleverly, and gradually. Tag Mechir Tzedek now writes, to Perush HaMakabi. Okay. Perush HaMakabi, I think you meant Perush HaMakabi, which is Rabbi Kahana's great book. Let's see, what's an interesting... Okay, we'll discuss something that's relevant to what I've been speaking about throughout this program so far. Harav Kahana writes in Perush HaMakabi about how the prophets warn us that a time will come when Hashem punishes the Jews and they don't learn. It doesn't help because, you know, there was a time in Sefer Shoftim, the book of Judges, Sefer Shoftim. Every time God punishes the Jews, they learn their lesson, they repent, they do tshuva, and they become righteous again, and then God punishes them again, and then they go back to the evil ways as soon as the danger is gone. And this goes back and forth and back and forth. We see the same thing in Midbar Sinai, in the Sinai Desert, when they're wandering for 40 years in the Sinai Desert. The Jews in ancient times, there was a period when they were punished, they knew immediately this is Hashem. They understood that immediately, that Hashem, God, is punishing them. And they immediately did tshuva, they immediately repented, and immediately became good Jews again, at least temporarily, at least until the punishment was lifted. Then they'd go back to their bad ways in most cases, unfortunately. But at least when God punished them, they understood they're being punished, so you were able at least to show them, to teach them a lesson. The prophets warn that the day is going to come when Hashem is going to punish the Jews, and they're not going to learn. It doesn't matter. So no matter what the punishment is, the Jews are not going to learn their lesson. So even the Shoah, in the Shoah, the Holocaust, over 6 million Jews were murdered. Hashem Yikom Damam, may God avenge their blood. And still, it didn't teach the Jews the necessary lessons. Still, they continue. In fact, in many cases, it increased their disbelief. They said, where's God? How could there be a God if there was a Holocaust? God's punishment actually increased their disbelief. That's what happens in an evil generation. So it's a very, very bad situation. It's a catch-22 situation that the Rabbi Kahana describes in Perush HaMakabi, where God has to punish the Jews because they're evil. If they behave in an evil way and he doesn't punish them, it's like he's excusing and accepting their evil. So he has to punish them to try to correct them. But when he punishes them, it doesn't correct them. They continue. And sometimes it even increases their disbelief. So what do you do? No matter how many times you teach them a lesson, no matter how many times you punish them, they still don't learn. What do you do in a situation like that? Because that just brings more punishment, and then more disaster, and then more, and again, refusal to learn the lesson. And so the rabbi writes that the day has to come when this cycle is broken, when finally the Jews recognize punishment is punishment, reward is reward, we've got to do what the Torah says, we've got to do what Hashem says. Until we break this cycle and teach Jews, and inspire once again, emunah, faith in the Jewish people, true faith in the Torah way among Jews. Until we do this, until we reignite this among the Jewish people, we're going to have this endless cycle of ever greater punishment and ever greater refusal by most Jews to recognize the meaning of this punishment. So we got to break the cycle. We got to do it through education. We got to do it through having leaders that tell the truth and that explain and that convince the Jewish people. That's what has to happen. That's what Rabbi Kahana set out to do when, of course, he was banned and he was murdered. And he was on his way to doing it. And we want to do the same thing, of course. But until we succeed in reaching Jews with that message and convincing them, this cycle continues to go on. And the rabbi describes that in Perush HaMakabi. And he quotes from all types of sources in Chazal. I mean, you know, the rabbi does it, of course, brilliantly. Thank you, Tag Mechir. And now we go to the great LKZ, who writes, and I quote, Rabbi Yosef Mizrahi says we can't kick the Arabs out until Mashiach comes. Is he wrong? Unquote. absolutely wrong. Absolutely. And usually I don't like to speak with such chutzpah in regard to a rabbi, but this is absurd. Absurd. These are the same type of people who told us we can't have a Jewish state and the state of Israel will never come into being until the Mashiach comes. And most rabbis said that. Most rabbis said, you are not, most rabbis in the generation, in that generation, not Chazal. The rabbinic sages of the Talmud knew better. But I'm talking about the rabbis of the pathetic generation before the Holocaust. Most rabbis in Europe said, you cannot have a Jewish state until the Mashiach comes. It can happen. It's impossible. There'll never be a Jewish state. It's just going to lead to a massacre. It's just crazy. You're going to go to the Middle East. They're just going to wipe you out. It's crazy. You got to stay in Europe. That's what the vast majority of rabbis in Europe said. They were wrong. Dead wrong. 6 million Jews paid with their lives for that foolish thinking. On the contrary, we've got to get the Arabs out. And we've got to clean out the land of Israel and redeem the land of Israel and purify the land of Israel in order for the Mashiach to come, in order for us to earn the coming of the Mashiach. And so to claim that we just got to sit back, sit on our hands and wait for the Mashiach to come to do things that we are commanded to do. This is Torah law that you're not allowed to have your enemies living in the land of Israel. The only Gentiles that are supposed to live in the land of Israel are Gentiles who are loyal to the Jewish state and recognize Jewish sovereignty and believe in the laws of Noah. Those are the Gentiles who are supposed to live in the land of Israel. Now, I'm going to tell you something Rabbi Yosef Mizrahi perhaps doesn't teach you. Are Gentiles allowed to believe in idolatry? What if a Gentile believes in idolatry? Now, a Jew, we know, is not allowed to. It's a very serious offense, and there's no place in the world to come unless that Jew does tshuva. But what if a Gentile believes in idolatry? The answer is you never see the prophets in the Bible. You never see the prophets in the Bible, in the Jewish Bible I'm talking about. You never see the prophets in the Bible once criticizing Gentiles who engage in idolatry outside of the land of Israel. They criticize the Gentile nations for going against Israel, going against the Jews. And they condemn idolatry within the land of Israel. But they never, never say one word against idolatry outside the land of Israel. Throughout, and you see hundreds and hundreds of messages from the prophets, from the Nevi'im, in the Tanakh, in the Bible. Hundreds of them. But you never see one time when they tell the Gentiles outside the land of Israel, you're not allowed to worship idols. How could that be? The answer is that Judaism is very forgiving of the Gentiles who worship idols outside the land of Israel because Gentiles weren't born and raised as Jews. You can't expect them to understand Judaism and become Jews. You can't expect that. It's not fair to demand that of them. They were born and raised in a different environment. Sometimes they turn to idolatry. Sometimes they don't turn to idolatry. It depends. There are Gentiles who don't believe in idolatry and never engage in idolatry. There are Gentiles who do. But Judaism is very forgiving of Gentiles outside the land of Israel. Again, in the land of Israel, it's absolutely not permissible. Absolutely not. In the Holy Land, absolutely not permissible. But outside the land of Israel? Outside the land of Israel, even if Gentiles have a distorted view of God, you never see once the Hebrew prophets, never once condemning them for it or preaching against it or speaking against it, even though they do direct a lot of their messages to the Gentile nations outside of Israel. Many messages, but never once say to them, you shouldn't be worshiping idols. Never once. And so, one of the things we have to learn here, I don't know how I got into that, but anyway, one of the things we have to learn here when it comes to the coming of the Mashiach, or when it comes to the laws of the Arabs in the land of Israel, is Harambam, in the laws of Ger Toshav, teaches us who is allowed and who is not allowed to live in the land of Israel. I know how I got into the talk about living outside of Israel, because the laws of living in the Gentiles who live in the land of Israel. The Gentiles who live in the land of Israel absolutely have to recognize Jewish sovereignty, have to be loyal to the state and the Jewish people. If not, they must go. That is Jewish law. And if we don't do it, we're violating the Torah. I mean, we're supposed to ignore what the Torah commands us to do when we have a sovereign Jewish state. and sit around and say, well, we can't do it. We have to wait till Mashiach comes. We can't do it. What, are you kidding me? It's absurd. Now LKZ writes, and I quote, is it better to finish university in America or go to Israel, unquote? Well, I don't want to speak for everybody here because there's some people that may not be suited to go to Israel right away. You know, you have to be well prepared to go to Israel. Israel is a different country with a different language and a different culture. You do have to be prepared. You do have to be prepared when you go to Israel. Otherwise, your aliyah will not be successful. But, generally speaking, if you have the necessary preparation and you know what you're getting into and you have a good plan, you should go to Israel immediately if you have a good plan ready. Once you have a good plan, you should go to Israel. You should go to Israel. And I don't think you have to finish university in America to be successful in Israel. It may not even help you in Israel. A university degree in America may not do you any good in Israel. So generally speaking, I would say better to go to Israel. Once you have a plan, once you have a plan in place, the biggest obstacle to a successful aliyah is language. You've got to learn Hebrew. Once you get to Israel, you've got to concentrate on learning Hebrew. You also have to, of course, figure out how you're going to support yourself, how you're going to make a living. That's very important, too. But the biggest obstacle to making a living and to adjusting and to doing all the other things you have to do is Hebrew, is the language. You must learn the language. That's very, very important. Anyway, thank you, LKZ. And now we go to the great Ephraim ben Noach, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, please talk about the 13th tribe of Dinah. Thank you, unquote. Ephraim, actually, I already spoke about that. Dr. Dan asked me about that, so I already spoke about that. So if you just, wind back to my answering, Dr. Dan, if you haven't heard it yet, you'll hear the answer. Thank you very much, Ephraim. And now we go to our great friend, Obama scum out of USA Now, who writes, and I quote, one, what country has the largest white population, unquote? I have no idea. Iceland? I don't know. I mean, once upon a time, there were many countries that were almost 100% white. In Europe, northern European countries were almost totally white. You never had black people or dark-skinned people in many of these countries in Europe. There were countries in Europe that were more than 99% white. That's not true anymore because people have opened up their borders and are allowing third world people to come in. So that's not true anymore. Is it important which country has the largest white population? Why is that important? I would ask the question, which country has the largest righteous population? Righteousness is more important than race, I would argue. It's true that whites, generally speaking, are better educated today than other groups. That's today. But at other times in history, that wasn't true. Anyway, the answer is, I don't know which country has the largest white population, but no country today is almost all white. Those days are long gone. Obama scum out of USA Now writes, and I quote, too, what should be Canada's official language? What about Quebec? Unquote. Oh, I don't know. I mean, you have a majority in Canada who speak English, and then you have a very large minority who speak French. I don't think Canada should split. I think Canada should remain one country. I know that there are French separatists who would like to split away Quebec from the rest of Canada. I think that Canada should remain as one country. You could have two official languages. You could have English and French, and people could just respect each other. What about that? What about if English and French and each side respects the other? Isn't that possible? Unfortunately, with Canada's very left-wing open border policies and immigration policies, eventually the official language of Canada is going to be Arabic if they continue like this, because they're inviting so many Muslims in that eventually English and French are going to become useless in Canada. Anyway, but then again, that's what's happening everywhere. You know, the Muslims are being allowed in everywhere. Just insane. And now Obama scum out of USA Today writes, and I quote, three, discuss Toronto Mayor Rob Ford scandal, unquote. I don't know if everybody heard about this. This is a guy, Toronto, you know, first of all, Toronto, we're talking about the I'm pretty sure it's still the biggest city in Canada. I think it's even bigger than Montreal. I'm not 100% sure. I think it's bigger than Montreal, Toronto. So it's a huge, modern city in Canada, very big, important city in Canada. And the mayor of the city was caught smoking crack cocaine. Can you believe this? This is a guy who repeatedly has gotten arrested and gotten into trouble for drunk driving and having marijuana and being drunk, and one time was marijuana possession. I mean, this is a guy who's just having constant problems with substance abuse, and now he's been caught and admitted that he smoked crack cocaine. Just crazy. I mean, you know, there's no question that anyone who smokes crack cocaine is not fit to hold public office. Should not be allowed to hold any public office. Someone who does something that crazy. That's my opinion, at least. Thank you, Obama scum out. And now we go to the great Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, "Please say the following with an Arab accent. Our beloved Muslim terrorist leader Yasser Arafat was poisoned with polonium." Your comment. Okay. Yasser Arafat died of AIDS. He was a homosexual who engaged in all types of horrific activity. I mean, this is a guy. I mean, there's so much testimony about this guy's homosexuality and the disgusting things that he did. I mean, this is someone who mixed blood with perverse sex. One minute he was ordering the murder of innocent Jewish babies and children in Israel. The next minute he was ordering the murder of even of his fellow Arabs in Lebanon. I mean, the PLO murdered, PLO together with the Syrians and the Muslims killed 300,000 Lebanese Christians in the Lebanese Civil War. And the next minute he was having sex with his bodyguards and having sex with all types of other sick people. I mean, he was just an unbelievably disgusting individual. Just a disgusting, hideous individual. He died of AIDS. And, you know, the idea that the Israelis poisoned him is ridiculous. Never happened. Thank you, Da Vinci. And now we go to the great paper cut, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim, I am a fan of the movie Escape from Sobibor. I think these movies should show the entire truth and not hold back like some do. What say you?" Unquote. I've never seen the movie Paper Cut, but sounds like a good movie. Sobibor, of course, was a Nazi death camp. And the Jews did indeed escape. Jews escaped and rebelled and revolted in that camp. And, I think it was in 1943. The Jews rebelled in that camp during the peak of the Holocaust. sounds like an interesting movie. I mean, I haven't seen it. But I agree with you that movie should show the entire truth and should not hold back. I absolutely do agree with you, Paper Cut. Absolutely. Thank you. And now we go to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, "Please rank in the order of who you feel is most dangerous." And there's a list here of five people. Okay, I'll rank them in order. Barack Hussein Obama is number one on the list because he's president of the United States, and we see the terrible things he's doing with Iran and the terrible things he's doing with Obamacare and just in every area. I mean, just endangering everybody here. So right now, because he's president, he's the most dangerous. The second most dangerous, I would say, is Hillary Clinton on your list. I'm going to get to all five of them, so everyone who's listening, you'll know who all five of them are. The first is Obama. Second is Hillary Clinton. Because Hillary Clinton is probably going to be the next president. God forbid, we're going to try to prevent it, but you know, according to the polls, she has a double-digit lead, and she's supported by the media and supported by all the people who gave us Obama. So the odds are in her favor. So she's the second most dangerous, and she would be just as bad as Obama in the White House, just as bad. And the third person I'd put on the list would be Chris Christie, because he now is the front runner, unfortunately, for the Republican presidential nomination. We're going to do everything we can to defeat him, but right now he seems to be he's the anointed choice of the Republican establishment. Very dangerous person, very evil person, and if he is the Republican nominee, then we have no choice, because I'm not going to support him, so we'd be Clinton versus Christie, and I would not support either one of them. And then we have, and by the way, Chris Christie, you know, he was asked about, he was asked on the Sunday talk shows. He was on four of them today. You know, always hogging the Sunday talk shows. And so he was asked about the first question that George Stephanopoulos from ABC asked him was about what John Kerry's trying to do, because most of the Republicans are attacking John Kerry for selling out on Iran. I mean, it's so obvious, it's such a sellout. He's basically allowing the Iranians to get away with building nuclear bombs and endanger the whole world. It's just crazy. So Stephanopoulos asked him about this because the Republicans in Congress and most Republicans are attacking the Obama-Kerry administration on this issue. Chris Christie refused to do it. He said, let's Secretary Kerry do his job. He said, I'm not briefed well enough to know about this issue. He ducked it. He deliberately evaded the issue because he supports what Obama's doing, of course. And he said, let's Secretary Kerry do his job. Let Secretary Kerry do his job. We'll wind up with nuclear bombs. We'll wind up with nuclear bombs in the hands of the Ayatollahs if we allow him to do his job, God forbid. But anyway, that's Chris Christie. So there's no difference. I mean, Christie and Clinton, there's no reason to support either one if he's the Republican nominee, God forbid. Anyway, he's number three on the list. And number four on the list would be Rand Paul, because Rand Paul takes votes away from Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is the only hope we have of stopping Chris Christie. And Rand Paul takes votes away from him, because there are people who are stupid enough to think Rand Paul is a conservative. He's not. And so he would be fourth on the list. And fifth on the list is Abe Foxman. As evil and disgusting as Abe Foxman is, and he is a complete traitor. He's a Jewish anti-Semite. He's a traitor. He's an informer. As evil as he is, and as evil as the so-called Anti-Defamation League is, and B'nai B'rith, a complete traitor organization of self-hating scum, as bad as they are, and they're terrible, as bad as they are, it's just one organization. So I would make him number five on the list. So that's it. Obama, Clinton, Christie, Paul, Foxman. That's the order I would rank them in. Thank you, EB22. And now we go to our great friend Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, do you believe the governors are more qualified to be president than senators because of their executive experience, unquote? No, not necessarily. We've had a lot of governors who were president who were terrible. Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, they were all governors and they were terrible presidents. So no, the answer is no. I don't think that their executive experience necessarily makes them a better president. I mean, was Jimmy Carter a good president because he was governor of Georgia? I happen to like the state of Georgia. I think it's a beautiful state. But Jimmy Carter, you know, was a rotten governor of Georgia and was one of the worst presidents in American history. You know, I think he was probably the worst president, may have been the worst president, although I think, you know, he's losing that honor now to Obama, because I think Obama now is probably replacing him as the worst. Anyway, thank you, Maimonides. I think it depends on the person. I don't think necessarily that it makes, that a governor necessarily makes a better president. I don't think so. Not necessarily. And now we go to the great Main Koran, who writes, and I quote, I don't understand waterboarding. Can't we just torture the terrorists by making them watch a marathon of Super Sweet 16 on MTV or with Bud Light? Unquote. Oh, I agree with you, Main Koran. I agree with you. Watching MTV would be much worse torture than waterboarding. I mean, you can't devise a torture worse than that. I mean, you know, although, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Some of these people are so stupid, maybe they would enjoy it. I don't know. Maybe, you know. But how anybody could enjoy watching MTV, or how anybody... And there's so many things on television that you could watch today. Not just MTV, but there's so many things on television that are such garbage and so disgusting. How this could not be torture for anybody to watch it. I mean, it should be torture for anybody to have to sit in front of the TV and watch this stuff. I mean, I agree with you completely. Thank you, Main Koran. And now we go to our good old friend, Christians for Jews, who writes, and I quote, one, what evidence is there for capital punishment, death penalty, unquote? Well, the biggest evidence is that God says that we should have the death penalty for certain offenses. It's in the Bible. And that's, I think God knows better than we do. And no matter what you say about capital punishment or the death penalty, no matter what your opinion is, one thing's for sure. If a murderer is put to death, they're never going to murder again. They're never going to kill again. I do think that it serves as a deterrent, by the way. I do think that it helps. But aside from that, at least you know that murderer is never going to kill again. And there's no other way to ensure that unless you give them the death penalty. Life in prison, we know that giving people life sentences, it doesn't mean life. Eventually they get out through this way or that way. Sometimes they escape. Sometimes they get out because eventually people say after 20 or 30 years, oh, it's enough, give them another chance. Then they go out and murder again. The only way you're going to be absolutely sure that person's not going to do that again is if you put them to death. And death is what they deserve. And now, if they murdered an innocent person, they what right do they have to live? I mean, it's a complete injustice to allow them to breathe, to allow them to have meals, to allow them to go on when they took life away from an innocent person. What right do they have to go on living when they did something like that? In terms of justice, in terms of morality. Christians for Jews now writes, and I quote, too, which is healthier, a healthy veg diet or a healthy veg diet with oily fish, unquote. A veg diet with fish is healthier because you want to have variety in your diet. Vegetables are extremely good for you. They're very important. Vegetable, but don't put unhealthy salad dressing on it. Don't put mayonnaise and garbage in these salad dressing, these garbage. You can make your own healthy salad dressing with vinegar and other things. You can make nice healthy, your own healthy little things that you can put on vegetables for flavor. But so vegetables are very, very, very healthy. Green leafy vegetables, super healthy. Super healthy, super important. But fish has things that you can't get only with vegetables. So you want to have a variety of healthy things, and adding fish to a healthy vegetable diet is good for you. Thank you, Christians for Jews. And now, the great Confederate Kahanist writes, and I quote, how would the liberal media react if George Bush signed the so-called Patient Protection Affordable Health Care Act into law? Thanks and God bless, unquote. If George Bush had done the things Barack Hussein Obama has done, if he had lied so blatantly and so repeatedly dozens of times publicly in front of television, in front of everybody, focused his whole campaign and his whole presidency on one big lie. If he had done that the way Obama has done, I can't even imagine what the media would do to him. I saw what the media did to him for the things he did, and he did some bad things too. I mean, Bush is a terrible president. He was terrible. But what they did to Bush, I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine if he had done what Obama has done? Forget about Bush. Ronald Reagan was basically a good president. He did a couple of bad things. He supported the amnesty law, which was a bad move. He did a couple of bad things, but most of what he did in his presidency was pretty good when Ronald Reagan was president. If Ronald Reagan, after all that he accomplished, if he had told a lie, 1%, as significant as what Obama did, they would never forgive him. You would never hear the end of it. Never hear the end of it. That's what happens when the enemy controls the news media. This is why, Confederate Kahanis, we've always said, we must boycott and defeat the media, boycott their sponsors, and create an alternative media. That, in the end, is our big hope. The media is our number one enemy. Our number one enemy is not Obama and not Clinton and not the Democrats. Our number one enemy is the news media. They're the ones that give power to those evil people. Thank you, Confederate Kahanist. And I want to thank everybody again for another program, which I very much enjoyed doing. Until next week, shalom.